This episode of The Amateur Traveler is brought to you by Intrepid Travel, off-the-beaten-path experiences to over 100 fascinating countries on all 7 continents. Visit intrepidtravel.com for more info. Amateur Traveler, episode 331. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about volcanoes, high-speed trains, and peace parks as we go to the island of Kyushu in Japan. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have 3 news stories for you. In the first news story, actor William Shatner learned that when you're choosing what to wear in the airplane, remember that you'll have to take your belt off, as he had his pants fall down during a recent TSA check. He's quoted to say, "It was awful to have people looking at me with my pants down, probably the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to me." Clearly, he's never seen any episodes of TJ Hooker. In the second news story, Airbus is coming to the realization that some passengers are not as svelte as they used to be, and they're looking at making the aisle seats 2 inches wider. That's the good news. The bad news is those of us who sit in the middle seat, or my favorite, the window seat, those seats will lose an inch in width. And the most misreported story this week is that Mac users are being charged more for hotel rooms by Orbitz. The real truth, though, is that Orbitz is showing Mac users more expensive hotel rooms, not the same hotel room at a higher price, but more upscale rooms, because they found that they're more likely to buy them. For links to all 3 of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. And in other news, you may have noticed the Amateur Traveler now has a sponsor. We're being sponsored by Intrepid Travel. Get off the beaten track with Intrepid Travel. Intrepid travelers discover real people and real cultures on over 1,000 different trips in 100 countries. Traveling in small groups averaging 10 people allows for complete cultural immersion, while local guides ensure authentic, safe experiences. Intrepid brings positive benefits to their host communities and is committed to traveling in a way that is respectful of local people and cultures. For more information and to request a free brochure, visit intrepidtravel.com. That's intrepidtravel.com. I'd like to welcome back to the show Andrew Dye, who is coming to us again from Melbourne, Australia, but this time not to talk about Melbourne, as he did last time, but to talk about Japan. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here again, Chris. Always enjoy it.
And when we talk about Japan, we're going to focus in on one particular region. And what region is that?
That would be the island of Kyushu, Chris, which is the sort of bottom left island. If people are looking at a map, it's the third largest and sort of southernmost island of Japan, other than Okinawa, which is a long way offshore.
Right. And why should someone go to Japan, but more specifically Kyushu?
Well, Japan itself is a fascinating country. We've been there twice in 3 years and certainly plan to go back again. Kyushu is, I guess, one of the warmer parts of Japan weather-wise, and certainly if you're going in the earlier part of the year.
Further south, that makes sense, okay.
Definitely. I mean, comparisons in temperatures, it was considerably warmer in Kyushu than in Osaka, for example, earlier on our trip. But we spent 6 nights on Kyushu during April, so we had a good chance to have a look around the island, and there's quite a few interesting cities and a fair bit of variety there.
And what kind of itinerary would you recommend for a trip about that length, about a week long?
It's a small enough place. It just gives you an idea of scale. For people in Europe, it's a little bit bigger than Belgium, and for people in the States, a bit smaller than Maryland.
Okay.
And I think locally, it's about half the size of Tasmania. So it's not a huge place, so it's quite easy to get around most of the sort of key areas. Traveling around on the train in Japan, as you probably know, is incredibly easy, and it's very easy to do Kyushu by train. It was recently, about a year ago, they sort of finally linked up all the Shinkansen, which is the high-speed train, through from the very bottom of Kyushu right through to Osaka. So you can do those journeys, I think, pretty much nonstop if you really want, but it's very easy to get around.
And I'm assuming that flying in internationally, you were not flying directly there. You were doing this as part of a larger trip.
That's right. Yeah, we actually arrived by train from Hiroshima, but we'd earlier flown into Osaka. But we did fly out of Kagoshima, which is the last place we visited on Kyushu. So you can fly in and out of there internationally. I think there might also be flights into Nagasaki as well.
Okay.
But that was, for example, via Seoul. So we flew on Korean Air into Seoul and then into Osaka and out of Kagoshima.
And probably of those, the English-speaking world is probably more familiar with Nagasaki than any other city on the island.
Very much so, yes, which is a shame, as you can imagine. Yeah. It's always a shame when a city is known for such a sad event. But yes, without doubt, Nagasaki was the only place I'd heard of before we sort of started looking into going to Kyushu.
And what surprised you as you first went down there?
I think after the being in the main part of places like Hiroshima, Osaka, and Kyoto, which are all very big and very built up, a lot of Kyushu is quite rural. Uh-huh. It's very sort of volcanic and rocky, and we'll sort of come to that later on. There's a number of very active volcanoes that you can go very close to. But that does mean the island itself is very hilly, very green, and they're surprisingly rural in certain parts compared to the other bits of Japan I'd been to.
Okay. And so you started on the train. So your first stop, I think, as you said, was Takayushu.
Up front, I've got to say, I'm not brilliant at pronouncing these names.
Good. You're better than I am, I bet.
I've done my best. The main thing I know is that you're supposed to try and put the emphasis, equal emphasis on each syllable, which is very hard for us Westerners used to emphasizing, you know, the second or third syllable in a word. So, like, I believe the correct way to say Hiroshima is that way rather than Hiroshima, which is often how we would have said it in the West. So. But apologies up front. We started by coming in by train from Hiroshima to a city called Fukuoka, which is on the northern end of Kyushu. That took about an hour and 10 minutes on the fast train from Hiroshima, and I think it's about 2 to 3 hours from Osaka. It's basically the sort of entry point to the island if you're coming in by train. And Hakata Station, which is the main station in Fukuoka, is one of the biggest stations on the, I think probably the biggest station on Kyushu. And Fukuoka and Hakata is a little strange. There used to be two towns, separate towns, one called Fukuoka and one called Hakata, and they sort of merged, I think, in the late 19th century. They sort of came together, but the station, for some reason, is still called Hakata, which is slightly confusing. That was a really nice city. Unfortunately, we were only there for one night, which was a shame. It's definitely a place we'd like to go back to. As in many of the Japanese cities, the station is huge. Many of the railway stations are built into very large shopping centers.
Interesting.
With restaurants and often underground walkways and things. And Hakata is no exception. It's got a great branch of an amazing chain in Japan called Tokyu Hands, which is, it's a bit hard to describe. It's a bit like a combination of a DIY store, a craft store, and maybe sort of homewares. It's one of those places you can go and get those sort of only in Japan souvenirs. Like, I remember in the Tokyo branch, they had an alarm clock that had a different jingle for every hour, which matched all the jingles they play at the railway stations in Tokyo. So, and you can get lots of very fun things. A very interesting place to browse. But that there's a giant branch of that right at the station as well.
Interesting.
But it's getting away from, once you're actually off the train and looking around, there seemed to be quite a lot of tradition in Fukuoka, and that we went to one of the folk museums there, which I think is called the Hakata Machiya Folk Museum. And this had a very interesting section on the giant shrines that are carried. These are great big sort of wooden shrines, and it's one of the traditional festivals that they have each year in July, where different teams of men from around the city make these huge shrines and then carry them around.
Oh, okay. All right. I was not have the right mental picture. Okay.
Yes. Sorry, by a shrine. Yeah. You might liken it to a float in a fair or something, where, but they're made of wood. They're often very, very tall, and they looked extremely heavy. They had one just outside the museum, but they also had some footage from them or a recent festival. You had maybe a team of 15 guys carrying the shrine, and every few minutes, extra guys would come in and take over, because obviously there was a lot of hard work involved. And in July, which would be in towards the middle of summer, looked very hot as well. So very interesting museum. But that museum is also well worth a look, because they have a sort of craftsmen working there as part of the museum on particular local things. And they'll explain to you what they're doing and show you. For example, we saw a guy there making these exquisite sort of painted porcelain dolls. Not sort of like Barbie, but a sort of, if you can imagine, a very traditional Japanese style doll dressed in for female kimono and those sorts of costumes. And so he was painting them and explaining how it took the best part of 2 weeks to build up the different layers. And very, very interesting. And when you see someone who's got that level of skill, it's quite something.
Excellent.
Now, the other thing we did in Fukuoka, which was great fun, was go to a soccer match in the J League, which is the Japanese main league.
Oh, I don't think of Japan and soccer. Okay.
No, Japan's actually quite a decent soccer team. It's one of the top 2 to 3 countries in the Asian Soccer Confederation.
Huh.
And as luck would have it, a nearby team, Tosu, were playing at home the night we were staying in Hakata, which was in Fukuoka, sorry. And it was about sort of 15, 20 minutes away on the train. So we went to the match, which was pretty interesting because most people often think of the Japanese as very restrained and polite and calm.
Not so much at soccer.
No. And I believe also at baseball, which is you're probably more aware, is also a very big game in Japan. And they certainly let their hair down there. But it's interesting, though, that they are extremely organized. Their supporters are in very organized. They've got all their songs worked out. They've got huge banners and huge with spelling out the name of their team. For example, the Tosu was playing Hiroshima, and all the fans at the far end had all their banners, and they sang constantly throughout the entire game.
Going to a sports match in another country can be a real interesting experience that way, in terms of really getting a chance to know the culture in a different light, more, you know, in their everyday clothes, as it were, more what they enjoy doing.
Precisely, because, I mean, the museum was lovely, but clearly day to day for the average Japanese, that's not something they're thinking about. But at the soccer, it was literally, you know, this is what 10, 12, 15,000 people wanted to go and do that evening. And seeing them was great fun. It was a 1-0 victory to the home team, and they seemed pretty delighted about that. But one of the curious things, though, which we thought was really nice, was when we arrived at the station, which was just around the corner from the ground, so very, very easy to get to, all the staff were wearing the shirt or the jersey of the soccer team, which I don't recall seeing in some other countries. So you certainly got the feeling that there was a game on when you arrived straight away from the staff.
Interesting. And where did you go from there?
From Fukuoka, we then traveled to Nagasaki, which takes just under 2 hours on the train. That's not a fast train or Shinkansen. It's reasonably fast by most people's standards, but it's not the bullet train getting there, so it does take a little bit longer. And obviously Nagasaki, as you alluded to earlier, is well known for being the second place that the atomic bomb was dropped, which was, I think, about 4 days after the one at Hiroshima. But it was actually twice the size. The bomb that they dropped on Nagasaki was twice the size. It was 2 minutes past 11 on the 9th of August in 1945. And the sort of time of these things, that when you go to the museum there, they have lots of things like, you know, you have watches and various clocks and things, obviously, that stopped at the time the blast went off. So things like the time it happened. I think it was something like 100,000 people were killed either in the immediate blast or died subsequently.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And so obviously it was a huge, 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 huge event. And even now, although Nagasaki is a very modern city, we traveled to the area where the bomb went off, or the hypercenter, as they call it. And there's obviously a very moving memorial there to everyone who died. There's part of a church that remains standing despite the blast. There's not much of it left, but there's a little bit that for some reason wasn't knocked over, so they've kept that. Rather, as in Hiroshima, there's a what they call the A-bomb dome, which was the remains of a building that was right under where the bomb went off, but for whatever reason it didn't collapse. So they've also kept that. One of the interesting things they had at the hypercenter in Nagasaki was they'd excavated down to the ground level as it was on August 9th, and they've got a sort of glass window so you can look in and see what was there. And there's sort of scattered bits of debris, there's broken plates, there's tools and things that were around, all the things that were in people's houses or buildings, whatever, that would have just been scattered everywhere. So there's the Atomic Bomb Museum and the Peace Memorial Hall, which are very interesting and well worth a look if anyone goes there. It's probably not quite the size of the one in Hiroshima. And maybe it's because it was the second one, I don't know, but the Hiroshima one is huge, but it's still incredibly moving and, yeah, quite something when you sort of think of how easy it was. And the saddest thing of all for Nagasaki was it wasn't even a first choice.
I don't think I'd heard that. Okay.
Yeah, they were planning to actually bomb Kokura. And on the day, there was heavy cloud cover in Kokura, so they diverted to Nagasaki. So, And it even wasn't on the list at all. Kyoto was previously one of them. It all sounds very clinical, doesn't
it? Academic, yeah, clinical.
Yeah, yeah, people sitting, picking cities. But Kyoto was one of the original cities picked. But because of its concentration of ancient shrines and real historic UNESCO these days, most of Kyoto is classified under UNESCO, World Heritage Sites. I guess it was the committee who was making the decision dropped Kyoto off because they said if we bomb Kyoto, then there'll be no chance to work with the post-war population because everyone will just be so offended. And Nagasaki was put on the list, and then obviously on the day it got picked.
Hmm.
So very interesting. There's also a huge peace park. Again, all of this is around the center of where the bomb exploded. And there's an enormous statue there, which you can see from miles and miles and miles around. And little things like there used to be a jail or a prison located in that peace park. And obviously it was flattened and everyone who was in it was killed. But very parts of the foundations were left afterwards. So they've preserved the foundation. So you can see the sort of shadow of where the prison would have stood. But yeah, certainly quite a moving experience when you see it there. So thankfully, it's not all the bomb and the after effects of that. There's a couple of very interesting other places that are worth visiting in Nagasaki. For many years, Nagasaki was the only port in Japan that was open to Westerners. So in the early days, or in the sort of middle centuries there, most of the trading that went on came in and out of Nagasaki. So as a result, it was the first place of entry for many sort of innovations and things coming to the country. And the Dutch East India Company had the rights to operate the part of the port there. But curiously, they were confined to a very small island called Dejima, which is not all that big. I mean, it's probably 150 yards by about 50 to 60 yards. So it's not a very very small area. And it wasn't very far off the coast. I mean, we're talking 20, 30 yards at most. But the Dutch settlers who were there to operate the trading port weren't allowed to leave the island. So they were actually confined onto this little island for around 200 years. Certain people from the mainland could come onto the island and leave, prostitutes and some traders and so on, for example. But the Dutch people who lived there were basically not allowed off the island. So it's a very interesting little historic snapshot. And they've been restoring a whole load of buildings on this island. And it's a fascinating place to visit. Mm. But it was where things like coffee, chocolate, beer, all these sorts of things were first introduced to Japan. That's a really good place to visit in Nagasaki. There's also a really lovely Museum of History and Culture, which has a completely sort of recreated customs office from several hundred years ago. Very, very good audio guide there. I know sometimes these aren't always fascinating, but the one there was very good and was really, really good part of it.
Yeah, no, sometimes they go into quite a lot of detail. I think is probably the easier thing to err on rather than too little.
That's right. But yeah, this one was good. The other place we went up to in Nagasaki, and again, that we definitely recommend to people, is there's a cable car to the top of Mount Inasa, which has a viewing point over the whole city. Hmm. And basically, Nagasaki is situated in quite a narrow river valley opening out onto the ocean. And this cable car will take you up to a key point on one of those sides. But you can look out across the harbor and you look back up the river valley to the city. You can see the giant statue in the peace park, even though it's probably 10 miles away. That's a really lovely view from up there, and there's a very good suspension bridge out towards the harbor, and you look out to the islands too, so that's well worth a look.
Excellent. Now you're going up to the mountain there. Is that one of the volcanic mountains, or is that just
that one isn't? No, okay. That's it. May well have been, I'm sure it was, many moons ago, but not these days.
I'm just getting ahead of ourselves. Okay.
No, that's okay. There's a couple still to come. But yeah, Nagasaki itself, the downtown area is very nice. It's a lot of pedestrianized sort of streets and arcades. It didn't strike me as quite as high rise as some of the other cities. When you go to Osaka and Tokyo, you're constantly reminded that you're surrounded by enormous buildings, whereas the buildings in Nagasaki were not quite as high. There was a lovely sort of river canal running through part of sort of the downtown area with lots of stone riverside bridges that they lit up at night. So that was a really nice, we happened to be staying right on the side of that canal. And that was a really nice walk back from town going through there.
Excellent.
Okay, so from Nagasaki, we traveled on to Aso, which is indeed a volcanic area. Now, this is quite a long trip. We got up very early and did this from first thing in the morning. It took us just under 4 hours to travel from Nagasaki to Aso, but that was 1, 2, 3 different trains.
And you were doing this on your own, not as part of a tour?
Yeah, we just did it on our own. Mm-hmm. We were traveling. We had Japan Rail passes, which,
oh, okay.
You know, which you can have for 7 days, 14 days, 21 days. And there's some fantastic online resources for looking up train timetables and things in Japan. So it's very, very easy.
Even if you don't speak Japanese.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, these are in English. So it's extremely helpful. I've got to say, in general, traveling in Japan is far easier than certainly I thought it would be before we'd been the last time. It really is much more doable than might be apparent from the outside. But the longest part of that train journey, I mean, obviously there was almost a couple of hours back to the main line, about half an hour down on the Shinkansen, and then probably another hour and a half on the local train, which traveled from Kumamoto to Aso. And that basically takes you up quite a reasonable amount of elevation. And as a result, the train actually does a zigzag on the way. It pulls into a station and then reverses back out, comes to a siding, and then reverses back again.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Which is quite interesting and yet somewhat unexpected. And obviously they've anticipated this because the staff on the train, just before it's going to happen, they sort of walk through the train with a little sign and pictures, both in English and Japanese, just explaining what's about to happen so that people don't get too freaked out when the train starts going the wrong way.
Yeah, I would think your first reaction would be, oh my gosh, we missed our stop and now they're going back again. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, because even when you've caught a few trains and you feel a bit more confident, there's always that scenario when it starts going the wrong way. And this is really getting out into a very rural area. We saw quite a few wind turbines on the sides of the hills, lots of sort of dairy production. And finally, we sort of arrived in Aso. Now, Aso is in the middle of a caldera. You may know as a caldera, which is a collapsed volcano. Mm-hmm. Where you've had a volcanic cone builds up, it collapses in on itself and then looks basically resembles a crater. And then you would often have further volcanoes popping up in the middle of that crater. So that's the scenario we're talking about here. The crater or the caldera that Aso is situated in is about 77 miles in circumference. That's about 130 kilometers in circumference. So very, very large. And there are three sort of big volcanoes in the center of this caldera. And Aso is the small town and sort of the main rail stop near to those volcanoes. Aso is particularly well known for its milk. I think the cream must have a very high cream content. It's very rich. It's very expensive. They had bottles in the sort of visitor center there, and I thought we'd buy some milk for something else. And it was like $10 for a small bottle.
Oh, wow.
But obviously it was this very good, very much sought after local milk. So from Aso, what you do there, Aso itself is a lovely little town, very small, but just a really nice, with fantastic views. Almost anywhere you look has views of either volcanic cones or the rest of the crater or dairy areas and so on. Very, very picturesque.
And I don't know what time of year you were there. I don't think I...
Sorry, yeah, I should have mentioned that. April.
April, okay. And were the mountains, the volcanoes that were still within the caldera, still snow-covered or...?
There wasn't any snow down here.
Okay. You're far enough south.
Exactly. Obviously, there's a lot of snow and ski resorts up in the very northeast of Japan. But yeah, down in Kyushu, it's probably too warm most of the time. So there wasn't any snow. So we were very fortunate that it was also extremely clear conditions. So very, very sunny, very few clouds. So you had fantastic views of the volcanoes. And basically, from Aso, you get a bus which winds up to the base of the volcano. And I did look it up. Nakadake, which is the main volcano there, I think its highest point is just over 5,000 feet. So it's not massively high, but it's a reasonable size coming up from the floor. And then when you get off the bus, there's then a cable car, which you catch up to the edge of the crater. By this stage, you get into the point where there's no longer vegetation, or the vegetation is just scrubby grass. And certainly when you get up to the volcano, it's basically rock and rubble by this stage. Now, when you get to the top, there is steam blowing everywhere, and it is very, very active in terms of boiling water, I suppose, down the base of the volcano. Mm-hmm. And there's lots and lots of steam coming out. And within that steam, there's also some toxic fumes, as there would be.
Sure, right.
Volcanoes throw out this kind of thing. And so sometimes that area at the top of the volcano is closed off when the winds are blowing in the wrong direction.
Good to know. One
yes,
hopes
exactly.
The signage in English is very clear there.
It's not too bad, actually. Okay. Yeah, it's pretty good. And they actually have an indicator system with lights that shows you the sort of degree of toxicity, I suppose, of the fumes at the time. It's interesting when you do get up there because it's pretty barren. There is a walkway around the edge of the main crater. From that, you can basically look straight down into the center of the crater. But there's also, I can't really describe them, like eruption shelters, I guess is the best way of describing them. They look like little concrete shelters.
Okay.
Obviously, if it does start throwing out rocks and anything more solid, I guess you rush and sit in one of those for a while. So just in case you think it's a sort of tourist attraction to come and look at some steam, you know, that's a bit of a reality check that it obviously can be quite lively. But very interesting to go up there. There's some pretty good hikes around the area. There's the main active volcano in the center. The other ones either side of it, the cones are less active or relatively inactive. So there's some quite good hiking trails around them. The one thing we were slightly disappointed with, which we thought would be good, was there's a thing called the Volcano Discovery Center there, which is a sort of museum dedicated to explaining how volcanoes work. But it's very tired.
Hasn't been updated in some time.
Yeah, it was probably really good in the 70s or 80s. And I did a geography degree and Colleen studied geology. So we were kind of primed to be interested. But we came out thinking, oh, that was such a shame. As a result of all the volcanoes there, you also have quite a few hot springs and bathhouses and things with the hot water. But there's also spring water nearby. There was a shrine we went to in a nearby town called Miyagi, which had a very, very pure water. And people were driving up and loading up the boot of their car with containers to take home. It was quite a sight, actually.
Interesting.
So, yeah, also a real break if people wanted to see a bit of Japan that isn't a super dense city that's something out of Blade Runner. Then
Tokyo and shopping and things like that.
Exactly, yeah. So Aso is the complete contrast. That really nice, and particularly, I imagine, sort of April, May, June would be very, very nice time to be there.
Excellent. And is that towards the end of your trip, or do you have...
That was kind of the middle of the bit on Kyushu, and then the final place we went to was a place called Kagoshima, which is the main city at the bottom of the island.
Okay.
So we, again, caught the train back to Kumamoto and then the train down to Kagoshima. And again, this is a lovely, lovely city. It's a major port, but read somewhere in one of the guides that it was voted Japan's friendliest city in national polls down at Kagoshima. And generally on Kyushu, people seemed a little, I guess it's like a lot of rural areas in any country, I suppose, that people are a little more amenable, a little more welcoming than when they're rushing around in the city. So it certainly did feel quite nice when we were traveling around. One of the main things at Kagoshima is another live volcano called Sakurajima, or Sakurajima, I suppose many people would say it. And this is constantly puffing steam and ash into the sky. As soon as you see it, there won't be a time when either steam or smoke isn't coming out of the top of it. Hmm. It's almost formed an island, maybe a mile or two off of Kagoshima itself, and it's quite conical. And the last big eruption was just under 100 years ago. Some very big lava flows linked the far side of the island back to the mainland. So it's actually joined to the mainland, but it's a very big volcano. And I think in the visitor center on the island, they said it erupts something like 300 times a year.
Oh, my. Okay.
But eruption not as in throwing out hot magma around the entire area, but as in firing out particularly ash out of the top. So it's quite common for people to carry umbrellas for keeping ash off them. If it's blowing in the wrong direction, you could get ash coming down over you. And on parts of the island, there's a little tourist bus called Sakurajima Island View, a little bus that goes around and stops at the various sites. Many a time when you get off, you'd walk on the car park and there'd be a fine layer of ash on the ground, having come out of the volcano. But very interesting. The visitor center, by the way, in there is excellent and a really good display, actually far better than the Discovery Center up in Aso. This is just a visitor center that happens to have a piece on how volcanoes form, but it's far better than the other one.
Excellent. Anything else that stands out from the Kagoshima area?
The other bit is the hot sandbars. We did go down to...
Oh, did you? Okay.
About an hour south of Kagoshima itself, there's a resort town called Ibusuki. And this is the place where you can get buried up to your neck in hot volcanic sand, which was quite a lot of fun.
It's a black sand beach, is that
right? That's right. Yep. Yes, that's the one. And it's about $10. And you get given a sort of a yukata, which is a dressing gown, and you get changed into that. Then you go down to the beach and some people shovel lots of hot sand on you, which is quite interesting. I was prepared for the heat. The thing I probably should have been, maybe I haven't been buried in sand for many years, but the thing that struck me was the weight. I wasn't expecting the pressure and the weight. And you can hear your blood pumping around, you know, you can hear your heartbeat because of the density of the sand. It's quite a curious experience. And obviously it's very warm as well. So I think we managed about 15 minutes. They reckon normally, you know, you should do about 10, and some people like to hang around for 20, but I think by about 15 we were ready to get out.
Cooked.
Yes. So you get out and you go back, and then there's a hot baths and bathing area inside.
And all for the price of a quart of milk.
Exactly, yeah, a quarter of Aso special milk.
Excellent. In terms of times to go to the whole area, you mentioned the shrines, for instance, and the holiday in July. Do you know if there are any other special times of the year to go?
Obviously, as you're probably well aware, in the cherry blossom time is a very nice time to go to Japan. And that was partly why we were there in early April.
Okay.
Certainly further east in Kyoto and Osaka, the cherry blossom was fantastic. By the time we got down to Kyushu in middle of April, it also being warmer, probably the most of the cherry blossom was over. But certainly if you wanted to see the cherry blossom, you'd probably want to go to Kyushu maybe late March. It is a warm area. I mean, it was in the 20, 25 degrees Celsius, which is about 70 to 80 Fahrenheit while we were there in early April, which was very pleasant. Mm-hmm. I suspect it would get very hot in July, August. So you probably, and I think it would be quite humid down there as well. So I suspect the usual advice of shoulder season and spring in particular, probably the best times to be there.
Now, having gone there before, I assume you've used guidebooks or other resources. Did you find things that were recommended to you that didn't work out as well, that you would recommend something else for instead?
Probably the Volcanic Discovery Center was kind of mentioned in all the guides. Oh, yes, you know, this is really good. It's interactive. No one said it was tired, which I wish they would have done. But I don't know, we might still have gone anyway. But it just was one of those ones that was like, oh, I really, if I was saying to someone, go up there, I'd say, you know, skip that.
And you mentioned language that you actually got around easier than you thought you would the first trip you had to Japan, this being your second trip. Were there any times, though, that there were humorous misunderstandings in terms of the language?
I can't remember any particularly humorous one. There are times, particularly in the more rural areas, as is the case in many countries, you know, English is much more likely to be spoken in the cities around where visitors are likely to be. But you get to the more rural areas. I think I was trying to get a direction to the shrine in Miyagi, which is near Asa. And I had to just draw a picture on a bit of paper of an entry gate for a temple, and then eventually someone recognized it. But that was really quite difficult.
I've done charades before. I haven't done Pictionary.
it's simply because I had an idea. We'd been to a very famous shrine gate in Hiroshima, and I thought, well, if I draw that one, it's probably going to be something like this one. And lo and behold, it was. But that was quite fun. But equally, as we were walking down to it, I think the local schools were all kicking out. So, and every third or fourth child would yell across the road, hello, to us. they were very lovely trying out their little bit of English.
Sure. And picture this, you're standing in the most beautiful spot you saw in Kyushu. Where are you standing? And what are you looking at?
It would probably have to be up in the Aso region somewhere. Mm-hmm. On the way back down from the volcano, there's another smaller volcano which has been completely grassed over.
Okay.
It's just an absolutely perfect cone shape. And in the background, you've got all the caldera stretching out. So that's probably the loveliest part. That it just looks so beautiful and so green and so kind of perfect shape.
The most memorable local you met in your travels?
There's probably a couple. A lot of the locals we met were involved in the visitor industry, sure. I guess, somewhere. Probably on Sakurajima, which was the island off Kagoshima, the bus driver was very, very lovely. He didn't really speak any English, but he had some notes with some explanations in English. And every other place we'd stop at, we'd get off the bus, we'd be strolling around. He'd come bustling over to us with his little notes, and he was so wanting to make sure we understood what we were looking at. That was really, really nice. The other one was probably when we stopped in Ibasuki on the way to the hot baths. There's this funny little place that was a combination of a sort of a cafe, a radio station, and an information center. It was very, very curious, but it was staffed by this lovely old lady who, again, her English was very limited. And to be fair, our Japanese is pretty much non-existent. But she was extremely helpful. We had a lovely little lunch there, and she kept bringing things over. She brought over different delicacies for us to try. We hadn't ordered particular things, but because it was something that was local to that area, she wanted to try a small piece. So she kept bringing little bits over, which I thought was lovely.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Kyushu.
I think they're getting buried in hot volcanic sand. It's one of those things that, I mean, we were there, it wasn't the height of summer, obviously, so they have a sort of covered Hessian area, or they have a sort of roof over it so to keep the sun off. But you look around and all these people are lying there, and all you can see is their heads sticking out of the sand. It just looks so strange, and you're sitting there just wondering how long 15 minutes can last.
And I should ask, because I didn't ask at the time, there's a $10 charge to get buried. There's no extra charge to get unburied, right?
No. Okay. And thankfully, although it feels really heavy at the time, when you are ready to get out, it's actually not all that hard to pull yourself out of it. And I think actually Colleen, when she sat down, she was moving her feet about too much. She kept poking her toes out, so they came and shoveled more sand on top.
And when did you feel furthest from home? And when did you feel closest to home? When was it familiar and when was it not?
I'd have to say probably the furthest from home was standing at the top of that crater. We were looking down into this bubbling, and it's this sort of vivid, you might have seen this in photos, a kind of vivid milky green color and all this steam, and it's completely barren rock landscape that you felt pretty far from home there. Probably closest to home, I think, was probably at the soccer match, because I've been a...
You're from Melbourne. Yeah, we've talked about sport
from Melbourne
before.
And being from the UK originally also.
Exactly.
You know, I've grown up watching soccer, so... Most of the things there were extremely familiar, so being at a soccer match was very familiar, but it was lovely to see the locals kind of letting their hair down.
And you say most of the things were very familiar at the soccer match.
Some of the catering was a bit different.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I understand if you go to a baseball game, you don't get hot dogs. Yeah.
That's right. Well, I wandered down to find a coffee at halftime because it was getting quite chilly by, you know, 7-8 o'clock in the evening. We'd forgotten to take our jackets because it would be in a sunny afternoon. Mm-hmm. So I went to find a coffee, and I was queuing up at the food stand, and they were serving curry rice. They were serving little okonomiyaki, little pancakes, little balls. Very, very different to the catering you get in stadiums in the West. So that was pretty interesting.
Excellent. One thing you wish you had known before you went.
Each of these different towns often has their own specific version of noodles. Noodles,
oh, interesting.
Udon, ramen, mm-hmm. and other sorts of noodles are obviously a staple part of a lot of the dishes. And in a couple of times, I wish we'd known a little more about somewhere. We did eat at a number of good places, but sometimes I just wish either we'd had a bit more time or we'd been able to plan to go and try the particular delicacy of the region. Mm-hmm. Whereas sometimes mm-hmm. we ate at a nice noodle place, but it probably wasn't the specific local one.
It might have been
one.
More generic Japanese, okay.
Yeah. So interesting. If I redid some of this, we'd probably just make a little more effort to hunt them down. But that said, finding an address in parts of Japan is very difficult because
the system being so different, right?
Yeah, the way places are numbered is very different.
I think we've talked about that in the show before, but they number the blocks, not the streets.
That's right. And also sometimes I believe it's also something to do with when certain bits were developed.
Yeah, it's the house that's built in the block is number one, and then second one is two, and the third one is three, so it's not in order.
That's right.
As you walk around a block, the numbers will go up and down.
Exactly. So there's nothing to kind of say I'm getting closer or further away. So even on a couple of occasions when we'd found a really good recommendation of a very typical local restaurant, it might have taken us 20 minutes to find it just because of the difficulty of finding them.
Yeah, I don't remember whether we talked about that on the show before or not. So excellent.
I vaguely remember one of the guests who was in either Hiroshima or Kyoto mentioning something about that.
That could be where I know it from. Okay. Mm. And then in terms of money-saving tips, Japan has a reputation as being someplace expensive to go.
Yeah. Do you know, it's interesting. That's exactly the impression we had before we went there. But, I mean, firstly, if you are traveling around the Japan Rail Pass, without a doubt, although it's expensive to buy, it's way, way less expensive than buying the tickets themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think our pass for 2 weeks was around $500.
Oh, wow, that is expensive. Okay.
Which is expensive. However, I think we worked out that we did something like $800 worth of travel had we bought the tickets individually. So it might sound like a relative bargain, but that's less expensive. Some of the hotels, we stayed in a number of Japanese business hotels. This isn't the capsule ones, you know, where you sit in an illuminated coffin.
I don't hear a lot of people doing couple travel who are staying in the capsule hotels. So
exactly. But there's a number of chains of these sort of business hotels that we stayed several nights in, the Toyoko Inn chain in various cities. And they're very small rooms, and most Japanese hotel rooms are small because land is so expensive. But they're brilliantly designed. They've got everything in them. They're usually very, very close to the railway stations. And typically, they cost only $70, $80, $85 a night. Hmm.
Okay.
And they were really good.
We paid that for a really bad hotel room in Los Angeles just last week. So
Exactly.
I mean, really bad. Like, we didn't even sleep there the second night. We crashed on my son's floor because we really didn't want to go back to that hotel. So, yeah, that's really like not a bad deal.
Yeah, so the Tyoko Inns are good. We also stayed in a few backpacker hostels. And again, in Japan, they're really nice.
I would expect things to be very clean.
Yes, very much so. The one in Aso, for example, felt like a 3 or 4 star hotel. It was fantastic, absolutely fantastic. A lot of the public transport's pretty good value in terms of getting around in the cities. If you have to travel a bit further than walking around, the sort of travel passes are pretty good value, $5-$10 a day. Even eating isn't too bad. There's lots and lots of fairly casual places.
There are options at different prices.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we found a small chain called Utoya, which serves rice and noodle set meals. You get a tray with, you know, some pickles, and you get some miso soup, and you get rice, and maybe I had some smoked herring and something else. And it was $10. So really, really good.
Excellent. Before we get to our last two questions, anything else that people should know before they go to Kyushu?
People should be aware that most things are signed in English, and all the travel on the trains, everything will also be signed and spoken in English. So when they announce we are arriving, they'll tell in English. So don't be afraid from that point of view. Other than that, in terms of what they should know, I think they should know that it's just a fascinating place and really worth going to.
Excellent. Last two questions. Finish the sentence. You really know you're in Kyushu when what?
You really know you're in Kyushu when you can't tell whether it's cloud or volcanic eruptions in the sky.
Okay. And if you had to summarize Kyushu in three words, what three words would you use?
I think they would be volcanic, warm, and friendly.
Excellent. Excellent. Andrew, thanks so much for coming back on The Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your travels to Japan.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
In news of the community, I heard from Barbara this week, who said, "It was with some apprehension that I listened to your podcast recently, as I previously found American radio to be rather more nonsense than information. Not so with yours, I'm glad to say. Now that I found you, I'm keen to listen to lots more on my iPod as I do my daily walk. My initial choice was Dave Grunowitzki's first trip to India, which I thought was great. Then I managed to find one on Burma. Yippee. Now that that country is opening up, I'm sure there will be plenty of people who are keen to travel there. I'm planning a trip to Burma in November and have listened to the one episode I found on that country. However, there is plenty of scope for another program visiting different places and perhaps giving more detail about getting around and other things to do in cities, particularly for a traveler who isn't on a guided tour." And I wrote back Barbara, but I thought I'd share with the rest of you, yeah, this is not a radio show and is not governed by whatever the rules are of radio. I have been told by a radio consultant that I'm doing it wrong. In particular, that this show should be much more about me. I shouldn't let my guests talk as long. That basically it should be my voice at least every 2 minutes. I should probably interrupt the guests more and not let them drone on and on talking about destinations. But I'm going to continue to do it wrong. And then we have no current plans for another episode on Burma, but if anybody has been there and is interested in pitching me about any destination, there's a new webpage up that can tell you what I'm looking for in a pitch, and that is amateurtraveler.com/pitch-me, and you can find out how you could be on The Amateur Traveler. With that, we're going to bring this episode of The Amateur Traveler to a close. Thanks again to Intrepid Travel for sponsoring this episode. If you have comments on this episode, please leave them at amateurtraveler.com or drop me an email, as Barbara did, to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @Chris2X or join us in the Facebook community, facebook.com/amateurtraveler. If you like the show, leave a 5-star review in iTunes, or if you have an iPhone, download the new Podcasts app. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.